Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at TexasMutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, former San Antonio Congressman Will Hurd is now running for president and taking direct aim at Donald Trump and trying to make sense of the mess that is the Texas public school funding system. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Former San Antonio Representative Will Hurd announced on Thursday his bid to win the 2024 Republican nomination for president, and he is campaigning with a sharpened anti-Donald Trump message. He is entering a crowded field of more than a dozen candidates, but Trump is by far polling as the front runner, despite all of his indictments. Hurd, a former undercover CIA officer, is critical of Trump. But when he served in Congress representing the South Texas 23rd Congressional District, he voted with the Trump agenda more than 80% of the time. Hurd voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and he voted for the Trump tax cuts. He also voted in favor of a national ban on abortion. But Hurd did counter Trump on his signature issue, the border wall. Since leaving Congress, Hurd has been working in private industry, specializing in cybersecurity and artificial intelligence, which he calls major threats to national security. I spoke to Hurd after he declared his candidacy for president. Now, a lot of people are not familiar with the name Will Hurd across the country. This is, you can say, who, Will who? How are you going to change that?
You know, David, you probably have some sense. When I first ran for Congress in 2009, people are like, Will what? This isn't rocket science. It's about taking a message to places that haven't seen it, you know, haven't heard it before. And it's about talking about what people care about. And you'd be surprised what my, as we say in the business, my name ID is in other places. But I'm going to do what I always did in the 23rd when I represented that, which was larger than 26 states, by the way. I'm going to show up and talk about things people care about. It's not rocket science. It's old-fashioned hard work. And here's the reality. 23% of Americans vote in primaries. That means 77% of Americans don't. And one of the reasons they don't vote is because they don't think there's people in the races talking about things that matter and that they care about.
You've looked at the numbers. You know it's a crowded field. Over 12 mm-hmm. now have declared they're running for the Republican nomination for president. So how did you decide, okay, I need to get in and that there is a lane for me?
Options are a good thing. So we should be excited when there's more options in having these conversations. So it starts with that. Two, the part that frustrates me was that There's nobody talking about the issues that what I consider to be generational defining challenges. Everything from how the Chinese government is trying to surpass the United States of America as a global superpower to how are we going to deal with persistent inflation at a time when new technologies like artificial intelligence are going to upend every industry, and not in 20 years, but in 2 or 3 years. Those things, and that's the path. And like I said, I recognize that I'm a dark horse candidate, and but this is a path that we've researched and understand and know is out there, and we're going to spend the next couple of months building the organization to capitalize on it.
You do talk about the chaos that's been created by this lawless, failed politician Donald Trump. You are definitely going straight after Trump, calling him out for his problems. So talk more about that.
Sure. To me, it's real simple. And, you know, I saw this when I was in Congress and he was president. You see it now. He's only focused on the past. He's only complaining about the past. The fact that he's still complaining about an election that he lost. He's not talking about our future. He's only worried about his future. And that's a problem. And America deserves and demands something better than that. And this latest case, yes, nobody is above the law. And you're innocent until proven guilty. And this recent indictment in the case with the document, we wouldn't be in this conversation. We wouldn't be having these debates if he just gave the documents back. It's that simple. And the kinds of documents that he has, based on the classifications, was stuff that came from our most sensitive human sources. It was stuff that came from our technical intelligence and from our satellites. All of those things and information, when put in the wrong hands, could lead to the loss of American lives. And Donald Trump showed and proved he didn't care. And to me, that's not something that you want in a president. And then when you explain why you kept them, because you were worried your shirts and your shoes were in the document, but the boxes those documents were in. To me, that's just absolutely outrageous. And again, if the Republican Party nominates Donald Trump for our Republican nominee for president, then we are willingly electing Joe Biden for 4 more years, and we just can't have that.
And then all the down ballot stuff as well.
Sure. And look, I go back to people like, oh, there's recent polling that shows Donald Trump would win in a head-to-head with Joe Biden. And it's like, it's crazy to me. This isn't rocket science. Donald Trump has not won an election since 2016. And polling does not anticipate who will vote. It is a snapshot in time. And I remind folks that in 2022, the night before the election, most people were still predicting a red wave where Republicans were going to take more than 30 seats. And we didn't. We only had a margin partly because of Donald Trump. Donald Trump lost the House in 2018. He lost the Senate and the White House in 2020. He prevented a red wave in 2022. And if Donald Trump's on the ballot, we're going to get 4 more years of Joe Biden, and all the other candidates that are up and down the ballot are going to have a weight around their neck.
Back to your experience working with the CIA, understanding the toll, the cost, and human cost to obtain this information, these national security secrets, and how they ended up in Donald Trump's bathroom in Mar-a-Lago. I mean, what does that say to you? I mean, given maybe he was just keeping them because of, who knows, some compulsion, but still, how vulnerable was that information to other countries to acquire?
So again, the kinds of data that we're in there, right, would show us what our capabilities are. And so our enemies would know what we're able to do. And you can't easily come back from that. But the other thing that is frustrating to me is, why hasn't Donald Trump said, what steps did he take to protect those documents when they were at his place in Mar-a-Lago? What security did he have in place to ensure that his staff and the members that go there weren't being targeted by our adversaries like the Chinese government and the Russian government? We know what adversaries like the Russians and the Chinese take in order to pursue intelligence and information. And so what was Donald Trump doing knowingly that he had that kind of information? Why wasn't he protecting it? And ultimately, the question is, why wasn't he protecting the lives of our brothers and sisters, our spouses, our sons and daughters who are putting themselves in harm's way every single day and every single night to protect us? Why wasn't Donald Trump protecting them as well, too? And what steps did he take to do that? Those are the questions I want to hear him answer.
Will Hurd is a candidate for the Republican nomination for president. Going into the legislative session, many school districts in Texas were counting on a lifeline from lawmakers. There was an approximate $40 billion surplus, and these ISDs are in need of help. School teachers were promised raises, and the facilities are showing decades of heavy wear and tear. But that lifeline has yet to come. Instead, the Republican leadership is focused on tax cuts, but that's being hung up with infighting. Texas Monthly staff writer Forrest Wilder shows us the desperate need in rural West Texas ISDs, and he helps us understand why Texas school financing is so complicated.
Why is the school finance system so complicated? Yeah, that's a great question. Some of the folks that I talk to believe that it is intentional, not necessarily that it was dreamed up to be complicated, but that it has become complicated over time. And that one of the beneficial byproducts of that is that it's very difficult for the average citizen to really understand how something as essential as public education is funded in this state. And also, a lot of people don't understand the connection between the state, local government, property taxes, and the way that we fund public education. It is inherently complex in the way that it's designed and run. And I think that opaqueness is a problem for people understanding kind of what's going on behind the curtain, which is really important. And essentially what we're seeing is a underfunding of public education across the board that at this point starts to look deliberative, given just how much money the state has right now to play with and is putting virtually nothing into teacher pay and just basic core funding for K through 12 education.
One fact that you tease out in your writing, that every district receives at least $6,160 per pupil. And this is known as the basic allotment. But when you look at that number, we know it to be just a number. It's not the product of an audit or a study or anything other than just here is a number. Is that right?
Yeah, that's essentially right. The legislature sets the basic allotment, which that's one of the key things to understand about, you know, how schools are funded is that number, the basic allotment, the per student funding. It's adjusted from 6,160 based on the profile of a district. You know, if you have special ed students get more, there's all sorts of weights and allotments that tend to bump that number up. But yeah, you're right. It's arbitrary. The legislature every 2 years basically decides whether or not to increase it. A key thing to understand here is the last time the basic allotment was increased was in 2019. And since then, we've had record inflation. Inflation has really eaten away at the basic allotment. Basically, at this point, it would have to be significantly increased for it to have to keep pace with inflation. And the legislature so far has chosen not to increase it at all. So come 2025, which is the budget that they passed recently, it'll still be stuck at $6,160. If it were adjusted for inflation, that number would need to be about $1,500 higher than that. So if you have a kid in a public school in Texas, they need another $1,500 to get the same kind of education, roughly speaking, that they were getting in 2019.
When the argument, the debate over private school vouchers was ongoing in the Texas legislature, they were talking about $10,000 that someone would get as a private school voucher, right?
Yes. And then also there was the Senate proposal was to give $10,000 to school districts for every student that they might lose to a private school. And that was an attempt, essentially a political solution, to try to convince rural Republicans who are opposed to private school vouchers because it would harm their schools to go ahead and get on board. There's a lot of numbers flying around out there and proposals vary, but essentially one of the fundamental issues politically and then also just sort of financially with private school vouchers is that they do drain money out of the public school system and therefore harm, again, roughly speaking, every other student who's still in public education. And I don't think that anybody thinks, even if vouchers were to pass, that the majority of kids would be getting their education at private schools. They'll still be getting educated at Texas's 1,000+ independent school districts and the charter schools and that sort of thing. So these are really key, important discussions that are happening right now. Dollars and cents that translates into the quality of education that the 5.4 million school kids in Texas are going to get.
Yeah, I just think it's worth pointing out that the basic allotment number, 6,160, and the $10,000 number they were kicking around for private school vouchers, that doesn't sync up. There's like a 40% difference between these two numbers. And I think that's telling.
Right. Yeah. So the basic allotment is it's you don't get less than that. But there are a bunch of weights and adjustments that occur. Like I indicated earlier, you know,
so that all goes to how complicated and Byzantine and Kafkaesque.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the thing I think that you're getting at is that $10,000 is sort of an average. I mean, we have 1,000+ school districts in the state of Texas. they vary wildly. Some are very poor. Some are very rich. Some are very diverse. Some are not so diverse. Some are in tiny towns. Some are in huge cities. Some are in suburbs. And so it's easy to get lost in the kind of, you know, sort of miasma of numbers and the soup of figures and facts and math that we have here. But the really big picture that I tried to tease out in this article is that public education funding in Texas is not just stagnating by some measures, it's actually decreasing, particularly if you isolate traditional independent school districts, which is still where the vast majority of students get an education. They are being essentially defunded by the state in favor of charter schools. And now with this private school voucher discussion, they're talking about essentially bleeding money out of that system and putting it into private schools. Now, many people are fine with that, because they think the public education system is broken or they favor private schools. But we just need to understand, regardless of where we come down on the debate, what the effect is likely to be on the part of our education system where the vast majority of students are currently educated and will continue to be educated in the future.
So to that point, you said there are people who believe that the public school system in Texas is broken, but you have to ask, like, who broke it and why, and whether or not that was a manufactured problem in order to defund them down the road.
You know, we could spend hours talking about this. I don't pretend to be an expert. What I think is kind of interesting, though, is that at the legislature, you have, for example, the Texas Education Commissioner, Mike Morath, who tends to try to want to change the conversation away from the fact that Texas is near bottom of the barrel in education funding by stating that money isn't everything, which of course is a truism. It's a cliche. Nobody's going to disagree with that. But I think it's important that we focus on the money, because how the money is spent and how it's allocated and who's paying, these are all important questions that talk about the priorities of the state when it comes to education. Again, the fact is Texas is near the bottom of the barrel and education funding when you look at it on a per pupil basis. Then when you look at particular school districts, for example, that don't have much property wealth and that are subject to all of these vagaries of the system that was created in Austin by legislators, for example, the school district that I highlight in my story, Fort Davis ISD, what you see is sort of almost like not an intentional conspiracy exactly, but a sort of conspiracy of forces to make it nearly impossible for this little school district and others to provide their students with a basic education through no fault of their own. I mean, the district that I highlight has no bus routes. It has no cafeteria. The starting salaries for teachers is about $33,000 a year. They have no track to practice on. The kids use old uniforms. The superintendent mows the football field himself. And yet they're running a deficit year after year after year because the state has made it extremely, if not difficult, if not impossible, for them to raise an adequate amount of money to provide a basic education. There's something wrong with that picture, it seems to me.
You focus on Fort Davis, West Texas, ISD. You also look at Alpine. You know, you're kind of looking at the West Texas area, but I've seen this in reporting I've done in South Texas, in the rural South Texas. We see it in East Texas, the panhandle. This is a Texas-wide problem. Even in some urban areas, they're having these issues as well. It's not just the rural parts of Texas.
Yeah, and again, it's Texas is such a huge state. It's so complex. It's so diverse. There's 1,000-plus school districts. Sometimes it's difficult to generalize, and sometimes people want to sort of say, what about this? What about that? And this school district's different. And that's all well and true and good. But what I tried to do was focus on districts that, yes, are sort of, in a sense, they are extreme, they are outliers. But also, if you talk to the people who run these districts, they say, what's happening here, if things don't change, is going to come for other districts. We're just the canaries in the coal mine about what happens when you allow funding to stagnate, when you don't address inequities and problems in this complex school finance system. So while today Fort Davis ISD, which is a tiny district in a tiny far-flung part of the state, is facing insolvency, what they're saying is that might be coming for some of these bigger districts too. And it may look different. It may be in a bigger district, you have more flexibility. You can, you know, lose teachers and other staff through attrition. You can close schools. You can cut here and cut there. But the result is a degradation in the quality of education at a time when kids are already, from the metrics we have, way behind in learning due to the impacts of COVID. So yes, I think that, like, the take home message is that every district is different, but most of them, unless you're really wealthy, are facing a similar set of issues.
What did you see facility-wise when you were at Fort Davis ISD? How's wear and tear looking?
Well, their two main instructional facilities were built in 1929. They're actually Adobe construction. They're cool old buildings. They actually held up pretty well, I would say, just because of the quality of construction from 100 years ago. But they're 100 years old. Like, their science lab is newer. Well, it's from 1973. And, there's cabinets full of chemicals that with labels that look like they're from, at least the 70s, if not the 50s.
But that's half a century ago.
Yeah, at this point, that's half a century ago. So essentially, most of what's going on their campus is happening in 100-year-old buildings. Their newest building is an ag barn. They built it entirely through local donations, which is awesome to see community support like that. But like, you can't run a whole district through donations and philanthropy, which is kind of what they're doing. Now that's another issue, which is that school districts in Texas essentially fund their facilities by issuing bond debt and then asking voters to approve a tax increase to pay it back. That works wonderfully in communities that have a lot of money. That works wonderfully in communities where there's complete buy-in and resources to do that sort of thing. There's so little state support, though, in some communities that it's basically economically and politically infeasible for them to go out and issue a bunch of debt and raise taxes. That's the situation in Fort Davis. So essentially, these kids are being educated in buildings that if this were happening in like a suburb of Dallas or Houston or San Antonio, or Austin, people would be, they would find it completely unacceptable, but it's acceptable there because those are just the circumstances that they have to deal with.
Also, over the last couple of legislative sessions, the lawmakers have made it more difficult to have these bond elections, putting language into the bond ballot issues that it's very scary. It has to say this will require a tax increase, even if it does not. So, again, we're seeing lawmakers doing things to make it difficult for local ISDs.
There's a lot of things happening under the hood, but the real big picture on that front is that in addressing what are really high property taxes that people are understandably concerned about because just how burdensome some people's property tax bills have become, what they're doing is they're forcing down school property taxes. The governor has now said he wants to eliminate school property taxes, which sounds great, but here's the problem. How do you fund those schools? Right now, the state is essentially saying, well, for every dollar that we don't allow the local school board to raise, we'll give you that dollar back. So the schools don't lose anything, but they don't gain anything from that. The problem, though, is that long term, if you eliminate, let's say what the governor says he wants to do, if you eliminate the school property tax, then you've taken away almost all the ability of local communities to raise funds locally and spend funds locally on their schools. And you have to depend on the Texas legislature, which is a terrifying proposition if you know anything about the Texas legislature. You have to depend on the legislature forever being able to find and be willing to spend money on an education system that's $60 to $70 billion per biennium. They have no dedicated revenue source for doing this. They're just counting on a good economy that generates lots of sales tax revenue and that sort of thing. Well, we had a recession not that long ago. In 2013, the legislature cut $5.4 billion from public education. But many of the experts that I talk to say it's just a matter of time. If we continue down this path, there's going to be another economic crash and schools are going to be the first thing that they turn to cut. And except this next time, it could be much worse because they've eliminated the ability to raise funds through the property tax, if that's right, what they choose to do.
And a sales tax is extremely vulnerable to the ups and downs of the economy. If there's a pandemic or if there is a recession, people for one reason or another stop spending money, then there's no sales tax and that drops off very quickly.
Well, and presumably, it was in 2019 when the legislature actually did put money into both property tax cuts and into public education. At one point, there was a serious proposal that was floated by the top leaders, including Abbott, to raise the sales tax to match the highest in the country, which is California. They were seriously proposing to increase the sales tax, which is highly regressive, and is also very high in the state, because they understand, they won't talk about this publicly all that much, but they understand that the money has to come from somewhere, unless you're just not going to have public schools and you're not going to have basic services. And they don't, we don't have a state income tax. So where do you get this money from? The business tax that we have, they keep whittling away at and never produced enough revenue. Well, it's a sales tax. So if you want to go pay a 20, you know, percent sales tax every time you go into the store, I mean, we could do that. It's just not going to be very equitable for working class people or middle income people.
And they're the ones who will bear the brunt.
Right. And right. And the property tax isn't particularly equitable either, but it's more equitable than a sales tax, which is highly regressive, because if you don't make much money, you know, all your money goes into buying consumer goods and services and that sort of thing. That percent that you're paying on a sales tax relative to your income is very large compared to a wealthy person.
All of this talk about eliminating property taxes, there's a fight happening between Governor Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick over how to get there and what can be done. Dan Patrick, to his credit, says it's impossible to eliminate the property taxes. That is a fantasy, and we can't get there, he says. But what is happening right now? Do we know if Governor Abbott is going to get his way with, he wants to do compression, which is a reduction of the tax rate, which applies to everyone who pays property taxes, including businesses and large property owners, people who own refineries and strip malls, whereas Patrick wanted a homestead exemption raised. So that would benefit only people who own their live in their homes. So how is that working?
Right. Well, they're at an impasse. You know, it's a standoff. It's kind of amazing because, you know, we came into the session with an unprecedented surplus of $33 billion. Everybody, all the top leaders were on board with doing property tax cuts. I mean, there was a consensus nearly across the board, including Democrats. We're going to do something on property taxes. And then somehow, amazingly, they pass nothing during the regular session. And then even more amazingly, they're locked in this standoff over exactly how to do it. And as you described so well, I mean, Patrick is being, I think, more of the realist here. I mean, he's right that you can't eliminate the property tax in Texas unless you just like don't want to have public schools and you don't want to have local government or all these things that people take for granted and count on. His proposal is more equitable. Essentially, the main component of it is he would raise the homestead exemption for residents' homesteads from $40,000 to $100,000. So, for example, if you own a $200,000 home, under his proposal, $100,000 or half of that would not be subject to the main school property tax, which is about 50% of the typical Texas homeowner's property tax bill. Whereas in the House, and what Abbott's also backing, they were focused, you know, solely on sort of tax compression, which is taking the school property tax that is paid not just by residential homeowners, but also businesses and industry, and compressing it dramatically over time. So essentially, you know, it's always a good question, who benefits? So under the Patrick plan, it's more just your regular run-of-the-mill homeowners that would benefit. No one's talking about renters, but so we'll just put that to the side. Under the House Abbott plan, it's generally more wealthy homeowners and businesses and industry that would benefit, proportionally speaking. They're in a standoff, and I don't think anybody really knows how it's going to resolve itself.
Forrest Wilder is a staff writer for Texas Monthly. His article is, Rural School Districts Are Facing Financial Ruin. Some state officials prefer it that way. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. We've got past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org. And you can download, subscribe, and rate us wherever you get cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.